Good evening, everyone. For those who are standing, if you're standing by choice, that's great. You're welcome to stand. There are seats in various places, including a completely new row over at the end there, so please feel free to sit down if that's your preference. And pretty soon we're going to have to sell seats on eBay, I guess, or something, right? Thank you all for coming, especially on what could have been a very snowy night, but turned out not to be in the end. I'm Mark Brazidis, the Director of Creative Writing, as well as an Associate Professor in the English Department. And on behalf of the English Department, Donald Hall and Laura Brady, and our wonderful Creative Writing faculty, Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Marianne Salmon, Emily Mitchell, Ethel Morgan Smith and Alyssa High, welcome. I've taught the work of tonight's reader in at least three graduate fiction writing workshops. Elizabeth Graver is a model writer for many reasons. She does exquisitely well all of what fiction writers are supposed to do: scene setting, character building, dialogue. And not to be overlooked or underappreciated, she writes beautiful, clear, exhilarating sentences. In addition to the above, what is compelling about Elizabeth Graver's work is the complexity of the people who populate her fictional worlds and of the worlds themselves. We discover her characters and the worlds they inhabit the way we might work through a series of Russian nesting dolls. But in the end, we don't arrive at something diminutive, but at something grand, a deeper appreciation of the human mystery, of our own complexity, of our fragility and strength, our selflessness, as well as our selfishness. Most of all, though, we arrive at an understanding of what it means to love and be loved. Elizabeth Graver has been awarded many coveted literary prizes, including having her work anthologized in the Best American Short Stories, Best American Essays, and O. Henry Prize anthologies. She has been a Breadlow Fellow, a Fulbright Fellow, a National Endowment for the Arts recipient. Her novels have been cited as Best Book of the Year and Notable Book of the Year by such disparate literary observers as the New York Times and Glamour Magazine. I could go on, but I would rather that Elizabeth would. It's a great pleasure to present to you Elizabeth Graver.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark. It's really an honor and pleasure to be here, and especially to have been invited by Mark, whose work I have long admired. Is this working? Can you all hear me? Okay. If you can't, you know, flail around or something, and I'll... Is it too loud? No?
Good.
That's good. I have decided tonight to read to you from Work in Progress. I have been working on a book for a pretty long time, and I really don't dare to say I'm close to being done, but I'm kind of close to being done, I think. And it's a book in four sections. It's four linked novellas, and they're set all in one place, which is a fictional place based on a real place, and it's a little spit of land in Massachusetts, southeastern Massachusetts. For those of you who know the area, it's not Cape Cod, but it's sort of the other side of Buzzards Bay, near New Bedford, Massachusetts. And it's an area where I've spent quite a bit of time and that fascinates me for a lot of reasons. So the book is set on a little two-mile peninsula that I'm calling Ushant Point, and it's set, the first chunk, which is a 100-page novella, is set in 1942. This is a summer community, but during World War II, the U.S. Army had a base there, and you'll see echoes of that in what I'm going to read. The next, and that's from the point of view of a Scottish nanny who's taking care of some children who are spending the summer on the point. The next section is narrated by one of those children, grown now, and her name is Helen, and takes place in 1959. And the next section, which is what I'm going to read from, is set in 1970 and is narrated by her son, Charlie. So I'm not going to, there's a lot coming before this. I'm starting on page 148. There may be a few moments when you feel a little disoriented, but it's also kind of its own chunk, although I'm reading you a little bit of what's a novella-length section. So what do I need to tell you? I'll tell you just a few names. Charlie's grandmother is Gaga. His great-grandmother was a naturalist who's actually based on a real figure who's the only true real person with a real name used in this book. And her name is, she published under Mrs. William Starr Dana, and she wrote some books, including one called Plants and Their Children, which is the title that I'm currently using for my book. So it's got a kind of recycled quality about it. It's a green book. And Charlie has a brother named Will, a sister named Caroline, a friend named Rusty, other characters who'll float in and out. But I think that's all I need to tell you. There may be moments that are a little disorienting. But so just to the section before ends when he's 10 years old, but it's from the point of view of his mother. And one other pretty key thing, he has an uncle whom he never met because he died during World War II. He was shot down by as he was parachuting from a plane over Italy. And that uncle is named Charlie, and Charlie was named after him. So he's kind of an important figure. He figures early in the book. So this chunk is called Trespass, and it's divided into sections. This book has a structure unlike any structure I've ever done, and it's been fun and scary. One, sometimes he went to break windows. Sometimes, once summer was in full swing, he went to read, bringing a book and a Coke or beer he'd taken from one relative or another's fridge, stolen, gifted, doors were open, help yourself. Mostly stepping over the collapsed barbed wire that had once kept the army in and the summer people out, Charlie went to look for things. In May, windflowers, wood anemones, and wild geraniums. In midsummer, wood lilies and pearly everlastings. After the first frost, waxy bayberries that he dropped into his pocket, determined to melt them into candles, though in the end they went through the wash and turned to gray, clotted clumps, leaving a stain on his pants. Sometimes he brought his camera, an old Canon his father had passed on. It wasn't a single lens reflex and was slightly broken besides, so that what you saw was not always what you got. A cluster of leaves become the corner of one leaf, a cloud turned empty sky. Still, he liked how the camera narrowed his field of vision and gave him something to do with his hands, which, like his jaw, still shook if he let them go slack. Sometimes he went to make out with a girl in the grass, or in the one remaining barracks with its rows of carotid metal beds, or in the open crow's nest of the concrete radar building, the only problem being that there was no girl, just the bright throb of his body, just his own tongue inside his mouth, his own hands down his shorts, just, it was how things were then at the best of times, at the worst, no throb at all, the bright throb of his thoughts. This book has a lot of parentheses, just so you know. Can't seem to stop them. Some of the others he knew had taken girls to the base for real. His friend Rusty, his cousin John, his brother Will. Somehow they had found girls who were neither their cousins nor their sisters and done things that seemed to Charlie like the disgusting and miraculous acts of feral monkeys. His own penis looked remarkably like a stinkhorn mushroom, a phallus impudicus or a mutinous elegansis, its head picked clean by insects, a delicacy in China, edible if you could get past the smell. And while he was not yet the mushroom man he would later become, already he knew a fair amount and noticed mushrooms everywhere, just as he noticed bones half buried under leaves, a fox's bleached white pelvis, the fissured skunk, the skull of a mouse or mole. In your jeans, his mother liked to say, in my jeans, as in trousers, thought Charlie tartly back. It was 1970. The previous summer, he had graduated from St. Mark's in the bottom third of his class and gone to Woodstock, where he took photographs of garbage for half an hour and left bored. In the fall, he went off to a middling, by his mother's standards, college in Ohio to escape the draft, he supposed, though he hadn't thought any of it through very clearly, to escape the draft or something else. His destination had proved problematic in a number of ways. 1, Ohio was landlocked. 2, it was a city. 3, in order to attend college, you had to bring yourself along. He had applied too late to get on-campus housing, and although his parents would have paid for something better, he found a dirt-cheap basement studio in a questionable neighborhood and didn't lock the door. And it was with great detachment and a certain amount of curiosity that he watched a burglar in a ski mask walk into his room one night and take his stereo and wallet as he lay not sleeping in his mummy sleeping bag, which smelled of salt and sea. Was that the first week he did LSD? Was it the next week? Sometime in there at a dorm party, vaguely trying to get into the spirit of the times, he accepted a tab from a guy in his Greek class. "Check it out, pal. This is quality stuff." Even at the time, part of him knew it was a bad idea. The pill was white, confetti-flecked, a child's birthday party. For the first hour or so, it had no effect at all, but then he smoked a joint on top of it, and it turned to fireworks, then scrambled his brain and left him shipwrecked, shorn. A week later, he did it again, not because he wanted it to do its work, but because he thought, in some kind of desperate, inverted logic, that the second pill might undo the damage of the first. Peeling, he thought instead, as the drug took hold. Or no, he did not think exactly. He registered, he witnessed, his brain peeling back and back and back, and at the center, nothing. No self, no I, no me, not even a brain to think the thought, except that there he was, and there somehow he knew himself to be, crouched on a linoleum floor in a dorm lounge, bent over his knees, wrapped around himself, but also splayed and spread. A batch of molecules sprayed into the air. "Johnny," someone said at one point, or was it Charlie or Jimmy? And "Hey man, you don't look so hot." And now he was rocking underneath a chair. They might have been poking him with sticks, the other students. He needed gone from them to cross the wall. And now the ceiling lamp had grown too large, the ceiling sunk too low, its lines unpeeling, running through him as if his body occupied no space. His brain, despite the fact that it, when peeled and parsed and set in view, did not exist, was shuddering. There was laughter in the room, too loud, and the magnified weave of a girl's wool sweater coming toward him. Briefly, it was beautiful, how he could see every color, shades of brown, rust, green, blue, how he could see. And then the arm swung away, and his brain started shuddering again, and shuddering, and shuddering, and was gone. 5 hours or so it was supposed to last, and then back to ground control, clutching the keys to the kingdom. Only wouldn't you know it, it didn't work that way for him. Not once, not twice. "Oh, Charlie, you idiot," his mother would say to him later, sympathetically, cruelly. "Why take a chance like that? To what end? Why, for once in your life, did you suddenly decide you had to be like everyone else?" After the first trip, he'd woken on the floor and groped his way home and slept for 2 days. The second time, someone got him over to the college infirmary. He woke to learn that they'd given him some sort of antidote to the acid that made his entire body break out with a rash that looked and felt like poison ivy. He didn't mind, was grateful even, for the itchiness on his arms, the sight of the welts rising up, how distracting it was, and how familiar. And he could look at his arm and think, "Arm," and feel the itch and think, "Itch." He was grateful to be in a long bed under a white sheet, tucked in so tightly that his legs felt pinned. "Will it turn round?" he asked the nurse, bent over near the bottom of his bed, and was surprised both at the slurred quality of his own voice and at the phrase that emerged from his mouth, strangely old-fashioned, like something his grandmother would say. Charlie is a boy, distraught over something, a broken bike, a wounded bird. His mother in a rage because he bombed a test or built a bomb. And Gaga always calm, "Don't worry, Charlie, we'll turn it around." The nurse looked up at him over a long expanse of bed. "Hmm?" Her skin was light brown, her accent like Belle's, his Caribbean nanny for a time. She'd married a postman when he was 11, moved to Queens, sent annual Christmas cards. "What they gave me, you know," he lifted an arm, displayed the rash. "Will it make it go away? You know what happened?" He was gulping air, couldn't say the thing out loud. As if observing a tree fall in a forest, he watched his arm drop down. "Stupid boy," Belle would have thought, "throwing away your future, wasting your fancy education." She'd been strict with him, but also kind. She believed in both Jesus Christ and voodoo and in the power of special milk to put a child to sleep. It worked. Might help some, this nurse said with a shrug. Won't nothing turn it around for sure except you and your maker. I don't believe in a maker, Charlie said. He was expecting a lecture, wanting one even, to be chastened like a child set on a path. But instead she turned toward the sink and washed her hands, then dried them thoroughly with a paper towel. Then turning back to him, she yawned, flapping a hand over her mouth. I don't, he started again. But now his own hands were shaking. His jaw had started trembling. He was dizzy, gulping for breath. It was not over. Once again, it did not seem to be. And as it started up again, his body bucking, he caught a glimpse for the first time of how far this time would stretch into his future, even as it looped insistently into his past. From some unseen place, the nurse produced a brown paper lunch bag. Breathe, she commanded, holding the open bag to his mouth. For the first time, he noticed that there was someone in the bed to the left of him and someone in the bed to the right, both watching him with open interest. He ducked his head. Was she trying to suffocate him? His new body was, would be, intermittently, for the rest of his life, jumpy. Do not touch me without warning. Do not send me to closed spaces. Oh, smiling, chub-kneed baby. Oh, barefoot boy with your fairy houses. Had any of it been true, or just a story he had now to shed? By then, her hand was on the nape of his neck, half forcing, half guiding him. He was breathing into the bag, feeling his own breath return to him, dark, papery, sour. That's it, the nurse said. Get your breath back, nice and slow. Later, in a small office down the hall from the room where he'd woken, a doctor called his parents and handed him the phone. We're coming, his mother said, after he refused a plane ticket home. Don't, blurted Charlie, unable to stand the thought of his two parents peering, how much like plastic figurines they'd look, and at the same time, how furious and disappointed. Flesh of his flesh, or was it vice versa, and he a piece of meat gone bad? You'd only, he told his mother bluntly, make things worse. He stayed at the college infirmary for two nights, hardly the only drug-addled student there. The place was full of them, and then there were the ones who'd been tear-gassed by police or burned their arms in protest, and a few addled vets on the GI Bill, and also the clean-cut, anachronistic girl. She might have been his mother or one of her sisters 25 years ago, with a black velvet headband and clear eyes and a sprained ankle up on ice. When Charlie left the infirmary, he resumed going to classes and felt towards his piles of books and professors, and especially the numbers in his calculus class, something new and strange and deeply grateful, akin to love. He could, he realized as the weeks wore on, appear almost entirely normal to the world, especially because the world was hardly looking. Sometimes in the middle of class, the floor would fall out from beneath him. Other times, as he walked along the sidewalk, his legs would cease to be his own. Then, eventually, it would pass. He'd feel fine, really, almost totally fine, except for the constant press of knowledge that it could happen again at any moment, and his underlying sense that he'd ruined the best part of him, his mind. His mother thought him a genius, and while Charlie had tried for years to escape her definitions, he also secretly thought himself, if not a genius, then at least extremely smart. His parents never came to Cleveland. They sent money, called with the names of prominent doctors. Could any doctor in Ohio really be prominent in their eyes? His father wrote letters detailing financial and practical arrangements and ending always with, I hope you feel better soon, love, Dad. We've had 5 days of rain here when I'd much prefer snow, his mother wrote in her round, girlish hand, like a pen pal from a foreign country. And in the same handwriting, in the same letter, is it over yet? It must be over. Promise me you'll never do it again. I won't do it again, he wrote a few days later. Easy enough to say because it was true. Also a lie. I'm better now. Days would pass before he managed to put a stamp on the letter. Days again before he remembered to find a mailbox and drop the letter in. For a moment then he'd stand there, envying the letter's passage, terror-struck at having let it go. On the phone sometimes, if his mother caught him in a raw moment or disarmed him somehow, he was more honest. I can't explain it. I'm not better, but I can't explain. Please stop asking me, Mom. His siblings still called her Mummy, but he refused to, once he realized how out of step it was, how high wasp. He said tomato now and fridge instead of icebox. One Saturday, he went to synagogue in Cleveland with a guy he knew, but like the mass at the Catholic church he'd wandered into the weekend before, it did nothing for him. I gotta go, he said to his mom on the phone. Less and less, but still now and then, she said they might visit or come to, or asked him to come home to New Jersey. I feel sure you'll soon be yourself, she'd say buoyantly. And what awful times we live in. And once, it's the strangest thing, Charlie. You're just like I was after my brother died. At least I think so. I've never felt so alone as I did then. Briefly then, he saw how selfish he was, for he'd lost nothing except through his own stupidity, his self. He might have said he was sorry then, but for what? The death of his mother's older brother a million years ago? And for having his name, her fault, but not being him? His own rashness? The fact that his mind had turned to cheese in Cleveland while guys his age, people he could have been but for flukes of birth and circumstance, were coming home in body bags? Anyway, his mother would have taken it wrong, taken it her way. I'm sorry for disappointing you. I'm sorry for not going to Harvard, or not remaining the apple of your eye, or not becoming a war hero. Though by now she, like most everyone else he knew, thought the war was a terrible mistake. Still, she liked her heroes a great deal, until they let her down. Instead, he said nothing. His breath was speeding up, the sweat starting. His mother's brother, Charlie, had jumped from the plane. His parachute had opened. He had unwrapped a hard candy and put it in his mouth before the Germans broke the rules of engagement and shot him down. Everyone in the family seemed to find the fact of the candy reassuring, even charming, for how it showed the young man's spirit of adventure, maybe, his calm in the face of danger, his joie de vivre. Didn't anyone see how totally weird it was that the Italian priest who came across the body had gone into a dead boy's mouth and found a peppermint half sucked? Or that in his letter to Gaga and Grandpa, the priest had, at some length, lamented the poverty of his church, so that his letter was clearly, among other things, a plea for money to a family he'd never met? And the candy like a pill diminishing, and the soldier, brother, uncle, son, with Charlie's name, one war blurring with another, except back then it seemed to have been all patriotism and victory gardens and joining up. And now it was all slash and burn or duck and hide or shout and spew, I gotta go. The psych ward at the university-affiliated hospital was a good place to spend the night when you were shaking too hard at home. People were nice there, the nurses especially, the pretty nurses especially. No one made you talk. He was not the first in his family to stay in such a place. His aunt Dossie had gone to a more upscale one for close to a year when Holly was 10 and gone back for shorter stays since then. His mother had never gone, but could, he thought, have used it. Only his Aunt Jane, of all the three sisters, seemed to have all her marbles. Somehow by day he went to classes because they distracted him and because it turned out that away from his prodding high school teachers and the trembling eye and ego of his mother, he loved to study and learn. It turned out that he loved ancient Greek and science and poetry, especially Wallace Stevens. She sang beyond the genius of the sea, the water never formed a mind or voice. From the outside, he knew it might have seemed odd that he could get A's in Greek and intro to bio and spend every third night or so in the loony bin. But there was a war going on. His friends and his cousins had not been drafted, too busy at their Ivy schools, but they'd all still learned, faster than seemed possible, to turn things on and off. Carry a protest sign, fuck your girlfriend, take your exam, eat your dinner, smoke some pot, watch the splatter on the evening news. His split was just a little different. Panic attack and loony bin versus classrooms with round clocks and beige desks and the lucid gear-like workings of the mind. His family was all on the East Coast. He needed the distance and hated it, missed his mother and hated her. He missed, most of all, Ashant, which is the peninsula I told you about. All winter in Ohio, he dreamt of it. Its land, its people who were, for better or worse, his own. Its land. In spring, the lottery was drawn and he lucked out, his number 218, though the mental hospital would probably have been enough. Then in May, the shootings at Kent State, just 30 miles down the road. At his own college, classes became teach-ins, finals were canceled, grades turned to pass-fail. Charlie carried a few signs, marched in some demonstrations. Everyone was chanting, so he chanted too, though in a thin voice from a distant planet heaped with jammed machinery, 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your fucking war. He did not decide to drop out of college any more than he had decided in a way involving all his faculties to attend. One sticky, humid Midwestern morning, he hauled his mattress, chair, and milk crates to the curb, flushed all his medication except the Valium down the toilet, and left the key on the sink in an empty Navrin bottle. Before, he had a beautiful sense of humor, and it still struggled cockeyed to emerge. Outside, squinting in the light, he left a stack of books next to a sleeping homeless man, stuffed a garbage bag of clothes and his grandfather's lamp into his car, felt in his pocket for the Valium, drove east. It was mid-May when he got there, the point empty except for the Ballards, who farmed the land at the base of it, and the occasional squadron of cleaners, mowers, or gardeners, and Joe Silva, the caretaker, who was turning on the waters in the houses and launching the whalers and beetle cats. Charlie's parents had wanted him home in Bernardsville, and his cousin Holly had invited him to crash in her living room at her Cambridge apartment, and one of his doctors in Cleveland had recommended that he stay there and start psychoanalysis. And Dr. Miller had, so kindly, in words that would stay with Charlie for the rest of his life, told him that these past few months had been the hardest he would ever know, and that things would only get better from here. Charlie drove barefoot all day and all night in his blue VW, an animal on return migration. When he got to Paden Aram, the village market had just opened, and he stocked up on rice, beans, and cigarettes, and drove on over the bridge across the harbor, down Gooseneck Road, past Salvador's, until the road dead-ended at the two points with their gates and private signs, Windy Point with its tightly clustered houses, other people's, Ashant Point, his. If it was not peace that he felt as he parked in front of the red house and got out, if it was not a settling, a solace, then it was the closest thing he'd come to peace since the night when the drugs had wrecked his mind. It was early afternoon and foggy, and the lawn smelled of thyme, as it always did, and his stone wall was just where he built it, hauling the rocks up from the beach in a wheelbarrow. And around back, the bittersweet and catbriar rose in greening, inquisitive humps, and behind them were the shad trees, and beyond that, the sea. And as Charlie stood barefoot before it all, among it all, he could feel, if it was not a solution, was it perhaps a start, the ground beneath his feet. And now I'm going to do a little bit of part two. The early months of that summer might have worked for him, he would later think. They might have functioned as a sort of self-prescribed rest cure. You can hear me? Yeah, I don't hear myself. Sorry. They might have functioned as a sort of self-prescribed rest cure, hibernation, meditation, were it not for several fucked up forces bigger than himself. If he could only have had, as he did for a time, the place to himself, with a friend or two visiting occasionally, and his cousins doing their own thing, but essentially leaving him alone, even his parents coming now and then, long enough for him to say hello, goodbye. Mostly, though, the days in their solitude, camera in hand, a diet of pasta and brown rice, beach peas, lamb quarters, wild sorrel, and now and then a striped bass he caught or was given by one of the men who came to fish off Gaga's dock, or tuna from Gifford's Market, and when he needed it, a Valium, though he hoarded his stash, taking a nibble at a time. He read when he could concentrate and when the print did not morph before his eyes. He took cold outdoor showers behind the big house every morning at 6 a.m. He ran. From the gate to the tip of the point was 2 miles, then 2 miles back, and he took paths to and sometimes Little River Road across the Slocum River, where a blue heron or a snowy egret often stood. And if the bird stayed frozen, good luck, and if it flew off, bad. 4 miles every morning, barefoot and bare-chested, no matter the weather, running and running until his blood filled his temples, bathed his brain. Blood, just blood and bone. He slept in the cabin behind the red house, constructed as a playhouse for him and Will when they were younger, with 2 built-in beds and paned windows, and he bought a double burner hot plate at Mars and a dorm fridge at a church sale, and he did not trim the path that ran down to the cabin, but kept it overgrown and tangled, involuted. Halogen persisting perception disorder, depersonalization disorder, involuted depression, ? He'd seen on his hospital chart in Cleveland, and later had looked up the word involuted. 1, complicated or intricate. 2, having petals or leaves that roll inward at the edges. 3, used to describe a shell whose axis is hidden by tight whorls. Guess what, he told his friend Rusty one night on the phone, I have a vaginal depression. And Rusty had snorted with laughter and said, yeah, you and the bearded clam. The motorboat they shared with Will, christened by Rusty. Charlie, so young and virginal for 19, so old and racked, wouldn't learn for a few more years that the boat's name meant twat. Months later, Charlie had snuck another look at his hospital chart and found TOS shell shock scrawled next to the first diagnosis. And he, had they can you hear me?
Yeah.
And he, had they confused him with another, not even gone to war. How was it, he would later wonder, that during all those weeks spent wandering the end of the point, he didn't notice the surveyor tags? For days on end, he must have walked right by them in a kind of necessary blindness, seeing stones and plants and sky and bones, but never this. And so to find out about the land being for sale over drinks in the Red House living room on Memorial Day weekend, as his mother perched on the couch and his father made gin and tonics, and his aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters and cousins wandered in and out, his Aunt Jane's baby a fat, staring lump, except when Charlie bent down and handed her a cracker, and then she howled, and his mother said, if you just cut your hair, Charlie, you have no idea what you look like. And Jane said, no, she's just exhausted. She skipped her nap. Charlie started to leave then back to the cabin, away from them all, the din, the shrill, but his father put a hand on his arm and said, stay a little. And so he did, lifting a Triscuit to his mouth, mock boxing even, with his little brother Percy, though his brain was in a shudder, you have no idea. He had, on and off, been looking forward to them coming, but now that they were here, he wished them gone. They all looked so familiar, his relatives, so thoroughly themselves, and at the same time, so much like someone else's family, cheerful, winter pale, abuzz with energy and talk, except for Caroline, who at 15 was hunched in a corner with a book. They discussed the Cambodian invasion one minute, the dock the next, how a limb had fallen on the roof of the maid's wing at the big house, had anyone told Gaga yet, how the renters coming to the portable and red house in July had no teenagers, thank God. Things were out of control. This, predictably from his mother, in the country, the world, the government, the social fabric, everything, her long, thin arm flung out, falling apart. Yeah, like this couch. This couch is shot, Will said. It was worn corduroy, faded red. They'd had it for years. They would keep it for years. I love that couch, his mother said. And for once, Charlie agreed. It was in the middle of such chatter that someone brought up Dick Wilson and the land. How much did he get for it, perhaps, or was it a done deal, or what a shame? Charlie wasn't paying attention. He was counting backward in his head. He was picturing them all as skeletons. He was remembering his pee that morning after his run, how it had come out the color of Coca-Cola, a dark red-brown. Should he tell his father, a doctor, or just let it go? For it had seemed, as he'd watched it arc into the bushes, a sort of purging, a purification, appropriate, even as his gut had cramped with fear. The conversation in the room narrowed then, took focus, so that by the time Charlie returned to it, it was in full swing. 3 house lots, maybe more, a new road being cut, zoning board meetings, and was one of the developers really from Japan? And was it true that the elder Wilsons were getting divorced? And if they didn't want the land, why wouldn't they give it to their children? The land and its house had been, before the Army took it, in the Wilson family since 1882. But the first time the Army shot off all its guns at once, every window in the point house had shattered, and then the radar caved the floors in, and the Army bulldozed the house. And when the Wilsons returned after the war, they settled on another parcel of land midway down the point, where they built a new house next to their old playhouse, which had somehow made it through the war, quaint and gingerbreaded, and was carried down the road on a flatbed truck. 3 modest houses might be better than 1 ostentatious one, his mother said. What are you talking about? Charlie cried out. And for a still moment, everyone was silent, remembering he and they both what they all knew, the drugs, the hospital. No one would mention it, out of tact or fear or both. And remembering, too, how Charlie was, had always been, the wildest child of his generation of summer wild children.
burrs in his hair, choked cherry juice on his limbs, and how the end of the point had been his favorite part because the most untamed, and also rightfully, if you believed in ownership of land, Charlie both did and did not, half theirs. Just 6 years earlier, Gaga and Grandpa and their old friends, the Wilsons, had bought the land back from the Army, with the 14 acres adjacent to the big house, red house, and portable going to the Porters, and the 12 acres, the choicest part, the tip, to the Wilsons. A hotel outfit from New Bedford had shown up at the public auction. So had, everyone was sure of it, a mafia man looking for a hideout who gave up $5,000 before the closing bid. At the time, the purchase, $125,000 for 26 acres, had seemed a cooperative and rightful reclamation. The Porters would hold on to their piece for future generations, and the Wilsons would rebuild on the site of their own house, old house. One house only the Wilsons would build, something in scale, modeled after the not ungrand but quite proportionate and lovely gabled house the Army had blown up. Because it was the Wilsons, they would welcome the other Point families onto their land, which had become, in the years since the Army had left, a rough-trod playground filled with weeds and wind and souvenirs of war, occupied almost entirely by the kids. Or perhaps, secretly, Charlie had always hoped for this, the Wilson clan, busy procreating or divorcing or making money in the city or relaxing in their perfectly nice house down the road, would put it off and put it off until the land took back what was left of the base, and the Wilsons let it go. They let it be. Dick Wilson, Jade's husband, Paul, said slowly, you didn't hear about this now till Charlie? I thought they'd been showing the property. Dick, well, he decided he wasn't ever going to build there. They had an engineer come, and it turns out you can't get rid of that damn Army casemate. It's too thick to blow up or knock down. So they'd be stuck trying to build on top of it, which is a headache, or else to the side. He shook his head. Either way, they'd never get back what they had, that chestnut of a house and the best clam bakes on the point when I was a boy. Though don't tell Gaga that. I guess Dick needs... Paul, Helen said, please. Charlie's not very... And then she was beside Charlie, hand gripping his shoulder, and he had an infantile desire to sink down and wrap his arms around her waist, even as he wanted to shove her aside and hear the rest. Dick needs what? Charlie asked. Dick Wilson was president of a company that put more breakfast cereals on America's table than all the other cereal companies combined. Snap, Crackle, and Pop, the boys liked to call the Wilson grandsons, though there were, inconveniently, more than three. Originally, in the 1800s, the Wilsons had bought up the whole point from the Cooks, a farm family grown tired of battling its rocky soil and windy fields. Slowly, the Wilsons' friends from New York and New Jersey had followed them, just five summer houses for a time, and even now, as the generations multiplied and the barns and barracks were converted to cottages, and new smaller houses went up behind the old ones, not more than 12. Dick's eldest grandson, Little Dick, was a few years younger than Will, and had been Will and Charlie's friend. Paul shook his head. He was somehow related to Big Dick Wilson, a cousin or second cousin Charlie forgot. Listen, we tried. Helen, could you explain? Nobody's happy about this, Charlie, his mother said. She'd sat back down on the couch. She was no longer mysteriously, mercurially on his side. She picked up an old copy of The New Yorker and began to leaf through it. Why doesn't Gaga buy it? Asked Caroline, looking up from her book, and Charlie felt a momentary rise of hope. His mother shook her head. The taxes alone would be too much. One of these days, this place is going to do us in. And Gaga, a widow now, and the future unpredictable, and the times are changing, and we should be grateful for what we have. Who spoke? Some of them? All of them? It didn't matter. The times they are at. One of his cousins started to whistle it, and another joined in. Charlie sat down on the edge of the coffee table. He was sinking, flying. It was they against him, all of them carefree, heedless. Jane's baby, Maddie, began crying again, and as her voice rose around above the talk, suddenly Charlie saw, in a flash of knowledge he hadn't known he had, the precise location of several surveyor tags, one on a stake to the left of Hollow Hill, another tied around a cedar tree near the shore, a third to the right of the Army Gate. When he left the house, no one called after him, nor did anyone ask or require him to stay. Outside, the mosquitoes found him quickly, but he hardly noticed. On the base, he came upon the first surveyor tag, ripped it off, stuffed it in his pocket, found the second tag, the third, then more he'd not remembered. To take them meant nothing, of course, meant everything. He circled the place, untying, pocketing. Somebody's idea of progress, was it? Big Dick Wilson's, like most of the husbands who came to the point on summer weekends and for a few weeks in August. Dick Wilson, jovial, casual, a man who liked to sail and amble, who wore shorts the color of tomato soup, and napped on his porch with a New York Times spread over his face. But follow these men to work, and who were they? They were law school deans, research physicians, CEOs, top attorneys. They were members of Harvard's Priscillian Club, men whom the communal hog farmers at Woodstock would have labeled with one red-rimmed appraising glance, establishment capitalist pigs. On the point, Dick Wilson, who'd not yet retired at 79, grew heirloom tomatoes and pale yellow raspberries, which he presented with a flourish to the ladies and the little girls. He told slightly off-color jokes. He often swam like Gaga in the nude. At the lunch after Grandpa's funeral, he'd stood up to speak, then let out a sob and sat back down. The surveyor tags, it turned out, were everywhere, dog piss aimed, sprayed, and laying claim. Some were half hidden by the brush and others in full view. There must have been 20 or more. After Charlie had found them all, he picked up two stones the size of a fist and went to the barracks. Others, his cousins and friends and local kids off season, had come here over the years to smash windows, so that by now there were only a few left intact. Charlie had gone along with it a couple times, tossed a stone or two, but he'd never been a smasher or breaker. Now, inside the barracks, he threw the first rock high up and watched it sail cleanly through the top pane of a window in the bathroom above a row of urinals. The glass shattered outward, still his hand flew to his eyes. The next throw in the bunk room made with a grunt and hurl at an already cracked window, and after that, he found another rock, smaller than the first two, on the floor, and threw it at a solid wall, which returned it back. For a few moments as he threw, he felt it, the clean edge of anger, the sharp, relieving point of contact, rock to window, rock to wall, and then a pinging sound as he hurled a chunk of broken brick at a metal bed frame and picked it up and threw it again until he saw a human being in the bed, until he saw the body of a soldier sleeping, an unknown soldier, or was it Charlie, stoned and being stoned?